Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program David Sinnoh. He's Clinical Professor of Finance at University of Illinois in the College of Business. And once a month, he's here on this program, and we talk about money management. The way we do it is that he starts out and has a few comments on a particular topic. Sometimes it's an investment sort of subject. Sometimes it has to do with financial planning. Sometimes it has to do with the economy. So he'll have a few things to share with you. And then if you have questions, it can be on that subject, on what it is that he has discussed or anything else that has to do with investing money management. I know he'll do his best to help you out and whatever your question might be. So with that, we'd say welcome back. Glad to have you.
Well, good morning, David. As always, of course, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I'd like to take a few minutes this morning and speak to a financial, well, let's call it a financial time bomb that is ticking every moment in the lives of millions of Americans. And that financial time bomb is the continual erosion of pension benefits promised to millions of working Americans. United Airlines employees are the most recent victim of empty pension promises as United tries to emerge from bankruptcy courts. In a nutshell, United could not survive if it was required by the courts to continue to properly fund its defined benefit pension plan. And as events unfolded last week, the courts transferred United's pension obligations to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, known as PPGC. Now, PPGC was established by the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. A lot of people hear the name ERISA. That was the actual legislative act to ensure that participants in pension plans receive their pensions if their plans terminate without sufficient assets to pay promised benefits. And indeed, that seems to be the case with United Airlines. If a plan terminates with insufficient assets to pay all of the promised benefits to its employees, PPGC will usually trustee the plan. In other words, they're really going to take it over and become responsible for paying benefits to the plan's participants and their beneficiaries. PPGC pays benefits according to the provisions of each individual pension plan, subject to certain guarantee limits. For example, they do not index benefit plans. However, by law, they must increase the maximum guarantee limit each year to reflect the increase in national wages. But here's the bottom line. For plans terminating in 2004, the monthly limit is $3,698.86 per month. That's the maximum a pension annuitant could receive at age 65. Now, take some of these United airplane pilots, some of the flight attendants who have been with United for literally scores of years. I know for a fact that their pensions are way, way, way in excess of $3,000 to $4,000 a month. In fact, some of those pensions are well in excess of $8,000 and $10,000 a month. Imagine suddenly United, now in the throes of bankruptcy, PPGC taking this over and saying, no, you're not going to get an $8,000 a month benefit, not a $6,000 a month benefit, but how about $3,600 a month? That's going to be the new game in town. That's a big problem for people who have built up lifestyles, who have retired. It's an enormous problem for retirees from United Airlines. Now, of course, who is PPGC? Well, folks, it's all of us because it is a quasi-governmental organization under the administrative arm of the U.S. federal government. So what does that really mean? That means when these pension annuitants start clamoring for their money, who's going to pay? So if a plan does become insolvent, despite cutbacks, PPGC has got to provide the financial assistance, typically in the form of a loan, in an amount necessary to pay at least these guaranteed benefits and administrative expenses. However, few plans receiving financial assistance from PPGC are likely to recover sufficiently to repay the monies lent to them. In other words, the American taxpayer is likely to get stuck with the baggage. I want to point out this number to you. PPGC currently estimates that plans that they could ultimately be responsible for are currently underfunded by approximately $85 billion, and this underfunding is getting worse each month. In fact, many commentators are predicting that several major industrialized companies will file for corporate reorganization and bankruptcy in order to specifically shed their massive pension obligations, which they can no longer fund. And as a result, if they do fund them, they can't be competitive. They're sort of in a catch-22. While United Airlines, of course, is the story of the day, the bigger story is the tremendous number of corporations who have dropped, liquidated, or frozen their pension plans and moved or replaced these plans with what everyone knows is called the worker-funded 401k plan. And it's happening at warp speed. As reported in the Washington Post on Wednesday just of this week, PBGC says the number of pension plans has dropped from a high of over 112,000 in 1985 to fewer than 30,000 today, and that number is shrinking each day. Traditional pension plans provide workers with a set amount of money each month when they retire, and workers, of course, generally accrue less retirement money in other types of plans, such as a 401k plan, where the worker is forced to save for themselves. The promise from the employer is simply gone. Younger workers, of course, who have many years to go before retirement, perhaps can make up those differences by stepping up their savings. But older workers, especially those like David and I, over 50, I guess we're the over 50 crew, at least according to the Washington Post, often face difficult decisions when they find that their pension plans are being changed because they really don't have the luxury of time. These older workers, experts say, need to study new pension offerings carefully and weigh alternatives that may include working longer or cutting back their retirement expectations. And some of our icon companies are joining this parade, or should I say exiting, from guaranteeing a pension benefit to its employees. For example, IBM has recently announced that starting next year, new workers will no longer be offered a pension, only a 401k savings plan. Big Blue is going the way of corporate America. Over the past year or so, a number of other companies, including companies like Sears, Motorola, NCR, Aon, have frozen their pension plans and switched exclusively to 401k plans. Dallas Salisbury, chief executive officer of the nonprofit Employee Benefit Research Institute, noted that just 20% of today's retirees are collecting a monthly pension. And that means, of course, 80% don't get one. And in the future, it's likely that that number is going to grow. Fewer than 20% are going to be receiving a pension benefit. And the vast majority of American workers in the private sector are not saving enough to have adequate retirement income. And that's potential disaster, according to Salisbury. All right, that's the nature of the problem. Now, let's briefly talk about saving for your own retirement, especially if you are unlikely to receive a pension. First, make certain that you thoroughly understand the retirement benefit choices offered by your company. Most private companies are now offering a 401k plan or other similar plan. In 2005, an employee can contribute up to 15% of their salary, or $14,000, whichever is less, to a 401k plan. Hopefully, the employer provides some type of dollar match based on the amount that the employee contributes. For example, for every dollar an employee contributes to a 401k, maybe the employer contributes 5 cents, 10 cents, 15 cents on the dollar for that contribution. In some plans, however, the employer does not match employee contributions, and such a plan is typically referred to as a naked 401k. In other words, the plan is simply set up as a retirement mechanism for the employee, but no special help coming from the employer. If your employer sponsors a naked 401k plan, you are probably better off funding your own Roth IRA program first before placing money in a 401k plan. Generally, as long as you have earned income, you can place up to $4,000 of income into a Roth IRA, subject to certain income limits, which most of us don't meet. And as many of you know, the beauty of a Roth IRA is that all of the gain, all of the earnings, grow tax-free. Not tax-deferred, but tax-free. And when you take the money out at retirement, you pay no income tax on any of that money so long as you wait until at least age 59 and a half to access that money. On the other hand, if your employer has a 401k plan and also does a 401k match, then you are probably better off funding the 401k first and at least up to a level to obtain the maximum employer match before funding a Roth IRA. So, for example, if your employer says, we will put 10 cents for every dollar you put into a 401k up to $2,000, well, you better fund so you get that maximum match from your employer. The real message I want to leave you with this morning is this. Employers and even our government are shifting the burden of a secure retirement onto the shoulders of the American worker. Therefore, it is incumbent upon each of us to begin saving earlier and saving more than we had originally planned for in order to ensure ourselves a decent standard of living when we leave the workforce, because we can no longer rely on the promises of either private industry or, for that matter, the government. We see that in the State University Retirement Program right at the University of Illinois. And that's an example of a government program as opposed to a private program. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to visit further about these issues or any other financial planning issues raised by our listeners.
All right. Well, if you want to give us a call, talk to our guest, David Sino, the number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we will pay for the call. And that is 800-222-9455. We have someone here to start with in Champaign, line number one.
Good morning.
Yes.
We have a modest sum of money. It's about on the order of $20,000 that we would like to set aside for a period of about 5 years and maintain its purchasing power while protecting against the various investment risks like inflation and interest rate rise. We've currently got it parked in a Vanguard money market fund, and we would like to transfer it over to another fund, and we're looking at the inflation-protected security and securities fund, bond fund. Do you think that would be a good choice, or is there something else that would be better?
I think with probably half the money at Vanguard, that would be a worthwhile choice. It certainly will protect you with inflation. And, of course, that's anybody's guess as we see these numbers all over the boards with retail and producer price inflation. Of course, a dramatic amount of that can be traced directly to a barrel of oil, and that's just very, very tough to call. And so you're asking the $64 question is how to get some type of return on your money and at least maintain your purchasing power. So I do like the Inflation Protected Securities Program at Vanguard with half your money. And then I would suggest with the other half of your money, and you could do this through Vanguard Brokerage, for example, is I think that you could purchase a certificate of deposit ladder, for example. You might take $2,500 of your money and buy a one-year CD, $2,500 a two-year, $2,500 a three and a four, for example, and then roll those CDs. So you have the benefit of some shorter-term money. You've got protection buying certificates of deposit, and you also have the benefit of the Vanguard Inflation Protected Securities Program. So I would probably do both. That would be my choice.
All right. Thank you very much.
All my right. Pleasure.
To the next caller. This is someone on a cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Hi. I have a pension plan from a company that I left about 10 years ago.
Yes.
I am 46 years old, and I'm getting monthly state, or not monthly, but annual statements that give me an idea of what my payouts will be when I retire and what the value of that fund is now. My question is there any way for me to get that money out of that pension and place it into some other instrument or vehicle that I control?
That's an excellent question. And what you will likely find out is that you probably are not entitled to a lump sum distribution. Most pension plans in the United States do not allow you to take a lump sum in lieu of an annuitized payment. And the reason that's the case is because a very substantial number of pension plans are not fully funded. They may be 70% funded or 80% funded or 60% funded. So if everyone had the opportunity to say, let me take the present value dollars of my future benefits out today, then there wouldn't be enough present value dollars inside the plan to pay everyone out. So that's the fundamental reason that typically in most of these pension plans, you don't have the option of taking a lump sum. However, having said that, there are pension plans that do allow you to take the lump sum, the present value benefit that you have, and that is a matter of plan administration design. That information would be laid out in the original plan design. So what you would need to do is call human resources at the company and ask, under plan design, do you have the option of taking a lump sum now and essentially rolling it, tax deferred, into your own self-directed rollover IRA? That's really what you would like to do. Because otherwise, you've got to wait until the earliest age of retirement, which might be 59, 60, 65, to get an annuitized benefit. Do we understand that?
Yep. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. That's very good. And let's go next to line number 3. This is a caller in Bloomington, Illinois. Hello.
Yes. We contribute to IRAs, and I contribute to a 403B through my employer.
Yes.
And when I get my statements of my 403Bs, they say variable annuity on them, and then like some of our IRAs are CDs, and I think when I go to retire, these are going to be handled in different ways, but I don't really know what that means when it says variable annuity for the 403B.
Well, actually, what you are in is a specific menu of choices in your 403B, and obviously in the 403B plan that you have, one of those choices is a variable annuity, which really means that you are in an insurance product, and this insurance product invests in securities, primarily stocks. And when you retire, basically, you will have a value that variable annuity is worth. And then, depending upon the rules of the game, depending upon your particular plan, you may be able to actually lump sum that, say, okay, the value of my variable annuity is $50,000, and you could roll that at the time of retirement into your own self-directed IRA, or you may be required to annuitize that variable annuity benefit, which means that you will have choices of taking it over your actuarial life expectancy. Regardless of whether it is 403B money or IRA money, and we're talking about traditional IRA money as opposed to Roth at the moment, both of those types of plans will require you to pay income tax on the distributions at the time you take the money out. So 403B money, I presume this is your money that you are saving out of your paycheck?
They contribute 5%, and then I'm putting an additional 15% in.
Okay. Okay, well, what's happening then is you're getting a tax break on that money going in. That reduces your taxable pay, and the institution is also putting in money. So all of that is what we would refer to as pre-tax money. So when you take it out, whether it's in an annuitized form or lump sum, it will be subject to income tax. What you want to check with your human resources folks is when I retire or if I terminate service at my place of employ, Can I take my variable annuity, basically cash it in while I'm still in the plan, and then roll it over tax-deferred to my own self-directed IRA program? Or, as an alternative, am I forced to annuitize that benefit over my actuarial life expectancy? That's the question you want to ask.
Well, our choices are sort of self-directed, like we pick the company to put the money in.
Yes.
So is there a disadvantage to having it be through this company, is Lincoln National, as opposed to having it be in something that's not an insurance product?
Well, and I'm not being pejorative toward Lincoln National. They're a fine, fine company.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But the truth of the matter is that almost every academic study that has ever been performed shows you that variable annuity products are very expensive products. That while they may make money, they make less money because of the tremendous expenses that are built into these products. And all of the things being equal, you would typically be better off in a mutual fund that basically mirrors the same investments in that variable annuity, because that mutual fund will have a lower expense ratio. Hence, more dollars will end up on your side of the ledger as opposed to the company side of the ledger or the investment side of the ledger. Do you follow that? So I typically
think so.
Do not recommend variable annuity products in a 403B. I'm much happier working with mutual fund companies or other choices.
Now, who typically would offer a mutual fund?
Fidelity.
Choice.
A Fidelity fund, a Vanguard fund, TIAA CREF.
These so you look for a broker of those particular funds?
Well, I think that you have to go back to your human resource people and find out exactly what choices I have. I'm not clear
yeah,
that you
I have choice of anybody, because I picked Lincoln National because I already had money with them, and they said it's a very small group, and so we totally picked our own person, our own company to direct the money to.
Okay,
so.
Well, if it were me and my money, and of course people have listened to me for a number of years, I'm an indexer. I believe in modern portfolio theory, so I probably would choose a company like Vanguard, which has very, very low expenses, and then put together a portfolio of index mutual funds at Vanguard. That would be my number one choice, if you have the flexibility to actually do this with your 403B money.
Now, can you roll over money to a fund like that from variable annuities, for instance?
Absolutely, unless
we do this.
Absolutely, unless there is a penalty charged by Lincoln National, who currently has your variable annuity. Variable annuities, if you come out of them too early, often have what are called surrender charges, a small back-end load, if you will. In other words, it could be anywhere from 7% down to 1%. So before you backed out of that variable annuity, you need to know what kind of penalty you would incur for cashing in that variable annuity.
Okay, thank you.
All right. My pleasure.
We are at the midpoint here of this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois. And each month on a Friday, he is here and we talk about money management. And he does his best to help you out and answer your questions. If there's some way that we could help, you're thinking about what to do with your money, planning for retirement, you're thinking about how do I send my kids to college, whatever your financial priorities are, you can call in here and get a little bit of advice. And it can be one piece of the big puzzle here. Of course, we want you to think very carefully, do a lot of research, get as many opinions as you can. But this is one place that you can stop here and get some advice. And I know Dave will see if he can help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And here's our next caller, someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My husband and I are considering moving our Roth IRA account into non-dollar funds. And this is an account that has some accumulated funds over the years, and each month there's money being put into it. And we're being advised about Templeton Global Bond Market or Bond Fund, and also their hard currency funds. What are your feelings about these global funds, non-dollar funds?
Well, what you're talking about are non-dollar denominated funds, and you're making a bet.
Mm-hmm.
You're making a bet that the dollar is going to continue to do poorly against other global currencies,
right,
like the euro. Now, that's the bet you're making. Could you maybe make that bet with 10 or 15% of your money? Possibly, yes. Do you want to make that bet with 100% of your money? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't think so. I'm not an expert in that area. And I have a feeling that if you talk to 100 experts in that area, you might get 100 different opinions. So, like anything else, where people are suggesting that you should hedge your currency risk, it's a very, very complicated business. And if you were going to do that, I would do that with a small percentage of your money. Now, a lot of the return that people have earned in these global funds, whether they are stock or bond funds, over the past several years has strictly been the currency difference in the funds.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they have earned this rate of return. And you know that the American dollar has performed rather poorly against the euro for about 2 or 3 years. And basically that euro just spiked dramatically over the last 36, 48 months, whatever it's been. And now the question is that going to continue, or are things going to sort of regress back to the mean? So it might very well be just the time that you get into this fund for this currency play that you could be finding that your timing is not very good. So if you were going to do this with 15 to 20% of your money, then I would dollar cost average into that position at least over a 12-month period of time. So that if you put your money in one particular day, you know, timing sometimes, and I don't believe in timing, but I know that you can have bad timing. So I would much rather have you dollar cost average into this position and perhaps only allocate 20%, maximum 30% into these global funds. In terms of my own asset allocation with my own pension monies, I am 70% U.S., 30% international.
Mm-hmm.
And of that 30% international, most of it is global stocks, not global bonds.
Oh, and why is that?
Well, because I think over long, long periods of time that stocks outperform bonds, whether you're in the United States or whether you are abroad. And of course, if you are in global stocks, and there have been substantial run-ups in global stocks over the last several years, again, a great deal of that is due to currency, as opposed to just simply the performance of international companies somehow doing better than U.S. companies. So again, I'm not opposed to it, but not a lot of money. And if you're going to do this as a currency hedge, you want to dollar cost average in to this position.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right.
My pleasure.
And again, we'll go to somebody else here. This is line number two, our next caller in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question concerning saving for college. The thing is, our daughter just turned one, so we wanted to start saving for college. The thing is, we need flexibility. My wife and I are from Germany, and while we're here with the university, we might be here in 5 years or in 10 years. We might stay in the U.S. We might go back to Germany. We might send our daughter to study to Germany. So what is the possibility to save for college but still have flexibility, sort of not having to send her to college here in Illinois or things like that?
Okay, that's a great question. And the best part of your question is that you're thinking about this at age one. So you basically have 17 years to deal with this question.
Yeah.
The bad news, of course, is that who knows what college is going to cost in 17 years, whether it's in the U.S. or Germany.
Yeah, it's much cheaper in Germany so far. It's a couple of $100 at most of a year.
Really?
Yes.
Really, as long as you're a German citizen. So it's
For foreigners also.
For foreigners also. That's...
So Americans should think about letting their kids study German.
Is it hard to get into schools for American kids in Germany? Because now you're raising something that's very interesting to everybody who's listening.
I don't know. I mean, I went to school in Germany. It wasn't that easy, but I think studying in Germany as a foreigner shouldn't be that complicated.
Okay. Well, that's interesting to contemplate. In any event,
mm-hmm.
presuming that whatever the cost is, it's going to be substantially more in 17 years.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, whatever it is, it's going to be substantially more. And, of course, we have housing and all of those other things
exactly.
that are apart from tuition and fees.
Exactly.
That I think to maintain the flexibility, I think you're a perfect candidate to start a mutual fund program and investing in mutual funds. And I would suggest that you look at some of the major mutual fund providers, perhaps the Vanguard family of funds, the Fidelity family of funds. And because you have such substantial time, 17 years, I would be a stock market investor.
Yes.
I would be investing in mutual funds that are well diversified between big companies, little companies, international companies, U.S. companies, et cetera. So I would probably be in a menu of five or six different mutual funds so that I have substantial diversification, and then I would dollar cost average each month, whatever total I'm going to put into these funds, maybe it's $300, $400 a month. Then how much are you thinking of on a monthly basis?
Well, at the moment, we probably wanted to start with $100 to $200.
Okay.
And then as long as, keep fingers crossed, we get a pay raise, sort of adjust that.
Okay.
Increase.
So one of the difficulties with mutual funds to begin with is many of them require a certain minimum to open them. That's one issue.
Okay.
So you might have to check and see what those minimums are with various fund families. However, sometimes if you open up something called a uniform gift to minors account, it's called a UGMA account, then there are smaller minimums that are required to open up those particular types of accounts, as opposed to just simply putting it in your name or you and your spouse's name.
Okay.
Those typically require more minimums. Now, of course, the difficulty with this is that when a child reaches the age of majority, typically 18 or 21, typically and legally, maybe that money belongs to the child.
Okay.
But heck, if you've done a good job, probably it's not going to be spent on one of those fancy German automobiles. Maybe it's going to be spent on one of those fancy German colleges.
But, well, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, you don't sound convinced of that.
No.
So.
Well, the fancy German colleges, I don't know. The variance in quality is very small.
All right.
There are not so many outrageously good ones, but there are also not so many outrageously bad ones.
Okay, good. Well, in any event, that would be what I would do. I would open up a UGMA account. I would look for a family of mutual funds that will allow you to start with minimum amounts of money. And the real key is not so much even what you invest in, as long as it's stocks, is doing it month after month after month on a regular basis.
Okay.
That's really what you want to do. And then you have that money. It's not really tied up. And you have access to those funds.
There's no possibility to do it sort of tax deferred, because then it would be sort of not, the flexibility would be lost.
Well, I think that's one case. And the other point being that if you do this in what I would refer to as tax advantaged index funds, the amount of taxation that you're going to be facing is very, very little, very slim, especially in the early years.
Okay.
It shouldn't even be part of your equation.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep, thanks.
All right, best wishes and good luck.
Yep.
And just to review now, we've talked about this before. If somebody is wanting to start saving for their child to go to college, and say that they live in Champaign-Urbana and they're thinking that their child will go to the University of Illinois, they might think, well, they don't think that someday their child's going to decide to go to Germany, but, you know, so they're going to say, supposing that they get to be 17, 18 years old, and they say, Mom, Dad, I want to go to college in Arizona. And we have been paying into
College Illinois. Right, which is a standard IRS-approved program to save for college. How does that work? What happens with that money? Have you lost it all? Have you forfeited it all? Absolutely not. Simply what happens is if you have saved up $40,000, $50,000 or whatever is in that account, or if you're in College Illinois, you would take the average tuition and fees for all of the state colleges in the state of Illinois, and at that time, let's say it's $10,000 per semester, you would then get a check for $10,000, which you could then tender to Arizona, Harvard, or wherever you went to school. So you're not losing anything by participating in one of these IRS-approved college programs. In Illinois, it's called College Illinois for tuition and fees. It's called Bright Start. If you want to go the mutual fund route and save for housing, I'm not very high on that particular program. I think there are better programs out there, but I do like College Illinois, which at least protects you against tuition and fee increases in the future if indeed you're attending a university in the state of Illinois And at very worst, you still get that benefit in terms of dollars that you can apply to an institution elsewhere.
And there, I think every state or almost every state has a similar program.
Absolutely.
And you don't have to be, if for some reason you live in Illinois, but you decide you want your child to go to school in Arizona, you can pay money into the Arizona plan, even if you do not live in Arizona.
That's correct. You can open up one of these plans in any state.
All right. Let's talk with somebody up in Chicago, in the Chicago area. This is line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We're recently retired, and my question has to do with what is the best way to invest in laddered bonds rather than buying bond funds to actually buy the individual bonds? And have them laddered so that they mature, you know, in a laddered fashion for income. Is there any particular way that's better to do that? Or?
Well, there are a number of ways to do that. And, for example, when we talk about laddering, perhaps we would talk about a five-year ladder, where you would go out and take one-fifth of your money and buy a one-year bond, one-fifth a two-year bond, one-fifth a three-year, four-year, and five-year, and so on. And if you were to buy laddered treasury bonds, for example, the one-year rate is about 3.3, and you have a two-year rate isn't very much more, maybe 3.5, the three-year rate 3.7, four-year rate maybe in the 3.8s, and the five-year rate about 3.8. So right now they're not dramatically high rates. And what I would suggest, because most people believe that ultimately interest rates are still going to go a bit higher, that if I were to set up a bond ladder today, I might only have a bond ladder that buys bonds over a 2 to 3 year bond ladder, and I would have maturities every 6 months. The point I want to make is that often bank certificates of deposit are paying more than treasury bonds. If you want absolute safety, you're looking at a U.S. Treasury instrument, which of course is guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, or in the alternative, you could look at certificates of deposit, which are insured by the FDIC up to $100,000. And right now, if you shop, you will find that in almost all denominations of maturity, from 6 months to out to as much as 36 months, certificates of deposit are actually paying a higher interest rate than U.S. Treasuries.
Huh.
So when you're putting your bond ladder together, it might be simpler, if you want to do your homework, is to do it through certificates of deposit. Also, you could go to a brokerage firm, and a lot of people don't like the idea of going to a brokerage firm, but brokerage firms, some of them are very, very good at putting laddered certificate of deposit programs together, because they shop the CDs for you all across the country. And even after they take their tiny commission from a CD, you are still ahead. You are still dollars in interest ahead. And then you have them as the bookkeepers, which I really like. I like someone else doing my bookkeeping for me, where I don't have to spend a lot of time and worry about it every day. So that is a possibility. Some people go direct to the Treasury and buy Treasury direct and avoid all the commissions and receive their Treasuries that way. But in a ladder, that's more difficult, and it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So I think all of these represent good alternatives. My only caution is that right now that I would be concerned about buying very, very long-term financial instruments on my bond ladder.
Right.
And I would also be very concerned about buying corporate bonds that tease you by paying very, very high interest rates, but there is some question about their ultimate ability to pay.
Uh-huh.
For example, some of the great icon companies of this country, the Fords and the General Motors, and the various subsidiaries that they have, some of their corporate issues are paying 6, 7, 8%, far, far, far beyond what a treasury instrument is paying. Well, what that suggests to the market is that there's a lot of risk there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, a lot of that paper has been downgraded from investment grade to non-investment grade paper. And I'd be real concerned about buying long-term paper in those kinds of corporations. Yeah. Owning their six-month paper, their three-month paper, I'm not terribly concerned. But going out there 3, 4, 5 years, that may be a little bit more disconcerting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very helpful.
All right, well, thanks for the call. And we'll come back here to Urbana for another caller. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, you were talking about finding mutual funds that had a low initial contribution.
Exactly.
And it seems to me, and I don't know, is this still true, that some mutual funds will also lower their minimum if you have an automatic monthly payment from a checking or savings account?
That is true. That is true. A number of mutual fund companies will do that if they can debit your account directly so that those monies go into the mutual fund. One of the difficulties for the gentleman who called, and in order to get really good diversification, you really need to use perhaps 4 or 5 funds. So that might create some problem. But again, I think a lot of these funds, even with as low as $50 a month contributions, if you debit directly, they may be available to you. So I'm delighted that you called in and mentioned that.
It could be a big problem, especially for people who are lower income, to come up with that initial chunk of money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very difficult problem, and it essentially shuts them out of the marketplace and able to utilize these vehicles.
I would suppose that you could get the diversity, if you were in that situation, to buy... putting, if you had a family of funds.
Yes.
By having it go first into one and then into, and then switching to another one.
Well, that's right. In other words, you build up enough money to start one and then you start the other one, et cetera. So that's a little bit slower, a bit more tedious, but certainly workable because you really need some exposure to both the big companies, the little companies, and this year is no better example. Even though stocks generally are down, if you are in big, big, big companies, maybe you're down 2 or 3%. If you're in the little companies this year, you're down 6%. So you need to be in both. Last year, you were much better off in little companies than big companies. So it changes. It changes. And you have to be able to deal with that volatility. Hence, you need that diversification.
And I thought about the Bush's wanting to have personal accounts for retirement savings as part of Social Security. My humble opinion is that we already have them. We have IRAs. And I've volunteered for the low-income tax program, tax preparation program that is done in Champaign-Urbana at the Urban League.
Yes.
And I've mentioned this to some people who seemed like they might have enough income to put some money aside, and they've never heard of an IRA. They don't know what the word, if they hear the word term IRA, it doesn't mean anything to them.
Doesn't compute.
Well, you know, it's just another acronym, and it doesn't say individual. Mm-hmm. People aren't saying individual
retirement account.
Accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that we would be doing much better by people to find ways to get to make it possible and feasible for lower income people to set up IRAs.
Right.
I was being fantasizing that, of course, this doesn't work for non-smokers, but every time a smoker went and purchased a pack of cigarettes, that a certain amount of money could go into their little IRA. I think about my father years ago. He would save for Christmas by having, there was a Christmas fund at the local savings
uh-huh.
bank.
It's very popular.
You don't see that kind of thing anymore. I don't see them advertised. It's a whole different.
It's a whole different world, and they're so difficult and expensive to administer. That's the major reason you don't see the Christmas savings plans offered at the banks any longer.
And obviously, my smoking and little extra tax on smokers that put toward their retirement fund or their health fund would be difficult to administer. But I was just kind of fantasizing and trying to think outside the box.
Well, you sound like a creative thinker, and thanks so much for calling.
Take care.
All right, let's go ahead and talk with somebody else. This is Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I have a question. How do you feel about using balanced funds to achieve diversification and thereby simplify the number of funds that are required in a portfolio?
I'm a little concerned about balanced funds because balanced funds typically mean that you're somewhere between 40-60 and 60-40 as a relationship between stocks and fixed income. And you are leaving it up to the financial advisor, the fund managers of that fund, to determine where we should be in that equation. I would rather make that percentage call myself and maintain that call myself as opposed to relying on the fund manager. Also, typically in balanced funds, unless they are balanced index funds, you're really back into what I refer to as active management. My fund's better than yours. I'm a smarter chooser of stocks or bonds than you are. And I really just dismiss that whole notion. So I'm a little concerned about balanced funds. I'll buy into a balanced fund if it's a fund of funds using index funds, and it stays pretty true to its calling somewhere in the 50-50 range. Then you could use it and reduce some of the mutual funds that you might otherwise purchase. But overall, I'm a little concerned because I think that they really don't stay true to their calling and they move too much. It's too active for my blood.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
my
thanks.
Pleasure.
Somebody wants to call in here quickly. I'm sure that we can get one more call. People who've been listening to you long enough, as you say, know that you believe in being in the stock market and being broadly diversified. And probably the best way to do that is then with a mutual fund. And you said that you really think it's important for people to have some of their money going into big companies and some into mid-sized companies and some into small companies. There are various kinds of funds that claim to be broadly invested in the market. There are total market indexes.
Absolutely.
And there are S&P 500 funds and this. But you also have made the pitch that those funds, they're weighted certain sorts of ways. So something that calls itself a total market index, that doesn't really necessarily mean that it is. And if you're going to get the kind of diversity that you recommend, you're going to have to be in more than one fund.
Well, that's right. And so many people buy the total market index, David, as you pointed out, and said, gee, I own the entire market. Well, that's true, except about 85 cents of every dollar are in the 100 largest companies in the United States. So you own very, very tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of all of those other companies. So that really isn't broad diversification.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take an Indiana caller here, line number four. Hello.
Hello. This is sort of hopefully some speculation from you. This morning we were talking about the airline situation, about the being able to get rid of their pensions. Now we got two big icons, Ford and GM. Got junk bonds for sale, and I've noticed over the past you've sort of speak in veneration of Vanguard. So I'd like to move it up a little bit. Is it so clear that the money houses in general are going to be just as reputable now as they might be later? Maybe they would like to make a move to fold back on what their obligations are later on. I wonder if you could speak to that in any sense whatsoever.
Are you asking whether the brokerage firms themselves are cutting back? I'm not clear on what the question was.
The caller has rung off. I guess what I hear the caller saying is that if we put our money into Vanguard or Fidelity or TIAA Cref or one of these big companies, can we rely on the fact that 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, that company will still be in business and our money will be secure?
That's a great question. When you buy a mutual fund, what you are doing is you are buying positions in each of those individual companies. So if you are buying an S&P 500 fund, whether you buy it at Fidelity, whether you buy it at Vanguard, or whether you bought it at the David Sinnoh Mutual Fund Company, that's irrelevant because under the law, they are really acting as trustees, if you will, and you have a beneficial interest in all of these companies. So whether Vanguard disappeared tomorrow or the David Sinnoh Mutual Fund Company disappeared tomorrow, you own the underlying positions in those securities, hence you are basically safe. Now, there might be some little dislocation, a little bit of expense, etc., but basically you own those positions. And so long as those companies are still around and they haven't gone down south, so to speak, then your investment is relatively safe in that sense. In other words, I'm not concerned about default risk from the master company who is indeed running the mutual fund. That doesn't concern me.
And though it is not like if you put your money into a mutual fund, it's not like if you put your money in the bank. There is no federal organization insuring that money like there is FDIC.
That's correct. And indeed, many people own money market mutual funds, which operate just like a checking account or a money market fund at a bank. And one has to understand that that is not guaranteed, that is not FDIC guaranteed. However, those money market funds invest in very, very short-term certificates of deposit, short-term treasuries, and something called commercial paper. And as a result, it's very unlikely that you would suffer a default in a money market fund offered through a mutual fund company.
Okay. Well, we're just about the point we're going to have to finish up here. Any last thing that you'd like to leave with folks?
No, the Wall Street Journal's been spending a lot of time recently talking about real estate bubbles. We talked about that a couple of months ago. It's rearing its ugly head again. Apparently, 20% to 30% of all housing purchases today are by speculators, especially in California, Florida, and some of the other hot markets. I'd be concerned about that. I think we are going to have some markets where we're not going to see these meteoric increases in prices. And if you are thinking of speculating in one of these markets, I'd be very careful, and I would sort of probably do a U-turn, so to speak, and not put my money in one of those programs.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
It's always fun. Just great questions from our audience.
David Sinnoh, he is clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business, and once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management.